Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. We're going to be looking at Psalm 23 this morning. I'm Professor Tom Egger, and let's just jump right into the superscription at the beginning of verse 1. Mizmor, the word for a psalm, or something played to music, or stringed music, a psalm le David, a psalm belonging to, perhaps authored by, David. Psalm 23 is, of course, one of the most familiar psalms in the life of the church, especially in American Christianity. It's been very, very widely popularized. And the attachment to Psalm 23 among Americans is maybe unique in worldwide Christianity in terms of our focus in at just Psalm 23 of all the psalms. But the appreciation of the imagery of God as shepherd, and especially of Jesus as shepherd, is an appreciation and a love for that imagery that goes back to the earliest days of the church. And there's a lot of passages in the New Testament itself which unpack this idea of Jesus as our shepherd, God himself as the shepherd of his people. In some ways, because Psalm 23 is so dearly loved and so familiar to people, it almost seems a little bit sacrilegious to tread on it with exegetical dissection and try to give super precise meaning to all of the things that are contained in all the images and the movements, because the personal language of the psalm has already invited hearers into an incorporation of the psalm into their life in a very personal level. A lot of Christians have heard this psalm so many times, and perhaps in so many different experiences, that this psalm has painted their experience into a certain mold, but also their experiences, and especially hearing this psalm in various experiences, has already painted this psalm into a certain mold in their life. And so we need to take a little bit of care as we go through the Hebrew grammar and the ancient imagery of the psalm, that we don't do so and in a way, or proclaim the psalm in a way that pushes out the richness that the psalm has already worked in working itself into people's lives as Word of God. But we're going to do it anyway, press into the Hebrew language and the imagery here. So verse 1 continues after the superscription with a very short four-word conclusion, really the introduction to the psalm. The first word of the psalm itself is Yahweh. Yahweh ro'i, lo exar. It's very short, terse language, but it captures a great deal in those four short words. Yahweh is my ro'eh, he's my shepherd. I will not lack. Kasar is a pretty common word in the Old Testament. It means to lack or to be in need. And it's used a lot in Exodus and in Deuteronomy to confess the fact that while the people are being led, the redeemed of God are being led through the wilderness, they didn't lack anything. It's also used in the curses in Deuteronomy 28 and then also in the prophets in Jeremiah and other places to prophesy the opposite, that when the people turn away from God, they can expect that they will be lacking. They will lack every good thing if they turn away from Yahweh. In Amos chapter 4, Yahweh says, I gave you lack of bread in all your places, yet you did not return to me. So lack can also be something that's brought about in judgment by God. But it includes primarily what is in view as physical blessings. Oftentimes, the direct object of the lack is lechem, bread or food, but it also can extend to spiritual dimensions as well. People can lack sense or wisdom, as they often do in the book of Proverbs. They can lack understanding. This is a blanket term, though, at the beginning of Psalm 1. Yahweh is my shepherd, therefore I will not lack. And there's no direct object given. So it's very open-ended, and it's an all-encompassing term. I will lack, I suppose you could say, nothing, no good thing. Verse 2 is the only verse in the psalm, or at these opening verses of the psalm, that really looks like a verse of Hebrew poetry. The two lines are quite parallel, but in the other verses, there's a little more diversity of form. Verse 2 begins with a prepositional phrase in its first line, and the second line of verse 2 also begins with a prepositional phrase. Binot deshe yar bieni alme menukot yinakaleni. First prepositional phrase is the preposition b, in, and the noun here is actually nava, and this is kind of an irregular plural of it, in pastures or in meadows of grass. So we have a construct chain here, in meadows of grass, sets up a genitive relationship, probably an attributive genitive here, in grassy meadows, you could say, or in green meadows. Yar bi'eni. This is a hifil imperfect with a first common singular suffix. He will, or probably better, a habitual or a customary imperfect. He ravaz me. He causes me to lie down. To rava is to stretch out or to lie down. So the hifil is God causing the sheep, who is the psalmist, and the psalmist's voice as a sheep here, to lie down in green pastures. The next phrase, alme manukot yinakaleni. All here, normally we think of the preposition all as primarily having a vertical sense, a vertical spatial sense, above or upon or onto, but can also have a horizontal sense, and when it does, it generally means at or beside. And so here, with waters probably beside waters of, may there is the word water in the construct, so beside waters of, menukot. Menuka is the noun resting place, or quietness, and it's pluralized here, so it's kind of a strange expression, beside waters of quietnesses, or beside waters of resting places. And this is probably an example of an abstract plural, where a word is put in the plural to denote an abstract quality. We end words like that in English oftentimes with hood, or ness, or ship, or mint. You might say refreshment. And Gesenius Couch makes the point that in Hebrew poetry, these abstract plurals are oftentimes used to intensify the concept. So you get a heightening here of the sense of rest. Maybe you could translate it beside waters of great refreshment. And the noun here, again, parallels the imperfect with the first common singular suffix from the previous line. The root is nahal, to lead. So beside waters of great refreshment, he will lead me. Verse 3 begins with a short line, Nafshi Yeshovev, my soul, he will shuv in the polel. Normally hollow roots like shuv don't have a distinctive PL form, instead they take this polel form. So you can think of this kind of as the PL of shuv. And if shuv means to return, then the polel probably has the sense here of to restore or to bring back. It, with the soul as the object, you'd probably say restore. Probably with the idea of restoring to some kind of an ideal condition or some kind of a previous condition. So in some ways, this echoes the thought of waters of great refreshment in the previous line. He will lead me beside waters of great refreshment. He will restore my soul. The next line of verse 3, Yan Kani Bama Gale Zedek. He will lead me, or he leads me. Naka here is a third hay root which has lost its hay as it takes the object suffix. Really, it's a synonym to Nahal at the end of verse 2. Both mean to lead or to guide. They're paired in many contexts, treated as parallels in the Psalms. So he will lead me, or he leads me, in paths or tracks lexicon here says tracks as of wagon wheels for Magale, in paths of righteousness. Probably another attributive genitive here, righteous paths. He will lead me in righteous paths. Lema'an Shemo, for the sake of his name, or for his name's sake. For his name's sake is a pretty loaded term in the Hebrew Bible. Yahweh is clear when he's redeeming the people, and especially when they've rebelled against him and he decides to forgive them and continue on with them as his people, that he's doing it for his name's sake. Ezekiel makes treats this language pretty commonly. I guess I should say Yahweh speaks in Ezekiel in this language often, that he is going to deal with the people not according to their wickedness, but instead Lema'an Shemi, for my name's sake. So here the psalmist confesses with joy that as God treats him in all of these kind and caring ways, that he's doing so for the sake of his name. It's interesting that this series of images ends on this note, for his name's sake, because in some ways, even though Yahweh is the subject of the verbs, the emphasis through these initial verses is very much on the psalmist himself as an individual. There's a lot of me and my all through here. The psalm began very strongly on a note of Yahweh, Yahweh Roi, Yahweh is my shepherd. But as soon as you got that my shepherd word, everything begins to sound very very me-oriented. So Yahweh is making me to lie down. He's leading me beside the waters of great refreshment, restoring nafshi, my soul. He is leading me in the paths of righteousness. But then you get this return to the focus on Yahweh, for his name's sake. And that return to his name serves as a nice cap for verses 1 through 3. The first word of verse 1 is Yahweh, and the last word of verse 3 is Shemo, his name. Verse 4, the image continues of the sheep metaphor, the shepherd metaphor. Gam ki elef. Even, and ki here is probably a conditional or a temporal particle. So even when, or even if, I should walk. Elek. This is our imperfect of halak, which acts like a first yod, loses its initial consonant. Even though I should walk, begay tzal mavet, in the valley, or in a valley, of a death shadow. The word for tzal, or the word tzal in Hebrew, is the word for shade or shadow, and mavet is the word death. So you have here an interesting combination of words. Some lexicons argue that this should just be translated darkness. But the idea here is this is a word that just generically means darkness. But I think you lose something when you don't acknowledge the presence of mavet as a part of this compound word. We have some interesting words in English that are formed in this way with two different parts that by recognizing both parts it adds something. But my favorite word that's formed like this is the German word for a light bulb, Glühbirne, which means glow-pair. And it has a pretty vivid image, right? It's one thing to say, well, actually the word light bulb is the same thing. We just don't think about it all that often. It has the word bulb in it, right? It describes a very distinctive shape. Well, here, tzal mavet is not just darkness, but it's death shadow, in the valley of the death shadow. We still have here shepherd and sheep imagery. God is leading him, and in the previous verse, and now even if I should go in the valley of the death shadow, sheep oftentimes walk through valleys, but I think by describing it as this valley of the death shadow, it also moves a little bit beyond mere sheep imagery, and also reminds the hearer and the prayer that this is very human language as well. It's also notable that the psalmist does not say that Yahweh is taking him into the death shadow, but now all of a sudden he himself is moving with his own initiative, even though I should walk, even though I should go in the valley of the death shadow. Lo, ira, ra. Get that interesting echo of the sound ra there. Lo, ira, ra. I will fear no evil, or literally, I will not fear evil. Why not? Next key clause gives the grounds for that statement. Ki ata imadi, for you are with me. The address to God here changes to the second person. God has been being spoken of in the third person, but now it becomes even more personal. The psalmist is almost picturing himself in the midst of the dire situation, and the language changes now. He speaks directly to God, for you are with me. Imadi is an alternate form of imi. It is just the preposition im with a first common singular suffix, with me. Shiv teka u mish antaka hema ya nakamuni. Your rod and your staff, they, hema, will comfort me. This is the PL of Nakam. This is what we see in Isaiah 40, comfort, comfort my people. Here it's the rod and the staff of the shepherd that are comforting of the psalmist, the sheep. James Mays says that these words for rod and staff aren't properly the normal words that are used for shepherds, but actually have more of a sound of kingly instruments. These sound more like a king's rod and staff. And in the ancient world, that royal imagery alongside the shepherd imagery wouldn't have been foreign. They were familiar with the idea of shepherd kings, kings as shepherds. And so here perhaps we have a little bit of a hint of royal shepherd language. Your rod and your staff, they will comfort me. Verse 5, Ta'arok lefanai shulkan, neged zorarai. You stretch out, or you lay in order, you set in order, arak. This is maybe lay them straight from, how's that go? 5, 6, pick up stick, 7, 8, lay them straight. Arak is the laying them straight. You arrange or order before me, lefanai, shulkan, a table. And there's some discussion in the commentaries what we should picture when we hear this image. You set in order a table. Is it a table like we're sitting at on legs that is elevated from the ground and flat, and you sit also elevated beside it? Or would this be like spreading out an animal skin on the ground for people to eat? I don't know that it matters all that much which of those things we picture. The main thing is that it's the shepherd himself who is spreading it out. The imagery is changing slightly here. It's still shepherding imagery. He's feeding his sheep, but it's also becoming very human. It's also merging into now host and guest kind of imagery. And we'll see that with anointing the head with oil here in just a bit. But this table is spread not just anywhere. It's spread neged sorarai, in the presence of, or before, in front of, my enemies. The psalmist's enemies in the book of Psalms are seldom only earthly enemies who just don't like the psalmist, but they're also the enemies of God. So they're the psalmist's enemies because the psalmist is devoted to God. And all through the book of Psalms, the enemies are quoted as mocking the psalmist for his faith, challenging the psalmist's God to help him and deliver him. The psalmist complains that he bears the reproaches of his enemies with which they reproach Yahweh, things like that. But here, Yahweh is pictured, the shepherd is pictured as honoring the sheep, honoring the guest, right in the presence of his enemies, vindicating him, in other words, which is the hope of the psalmist in the other psalms, where he's bearing shame in front of his enemies because of his suffering. Here Yahweh is vindicating him. Dishanta bashemen roshi. You have dishan. To dishan in the call is to be fat. And here it's a peel, which means to make fat, or to make fatty, make greasy, you could say. So you have made greasy, Bashemen, with the oil, my head. Doesn't maybe sound all that appealing to us, but this would be the way to honor a guest. If you were treating him to a banquet, you would greet him in one way by anointing his head with oil, pouring fragrant oil on the hair. I suppose back in the days where they didn't shower every morning, that was maybe a good treat, maybe for the guest and the people around him too. Kosi Revaya, my cup. And this next word is a difficult word. It's generally translated as a verb, overflows. But it's a noun in form. It means something like superabundance or overflowingness or possibly even intoxication. The idea is more than enough, complete saturation. My cup, and like I said, most of the translations simply take it as a verb, overflows. This is a great example of a verse where context decides the meaning of a word. The word kos here, kosi, my cup, could also be translated, the alternate meaning for kos in the lexicon is screech owl. And so, you know, what are you going to do in this context? Are you going to say, my screech owl overflows, or my cup overflows? Probably we'll go with cup in this example. Context makes it pretty clear. All right, verse 6. Aktov vakesed yar defuni. Ach, surely. Tov vakesed. Substantive adjective here for tov, goodness. And kesed, loving kindness, mercy. Surely these things, they will follow me, is the verb here. Radaf, it's a plural imperfect, again with a first common singular suffix. Surely goodness and mercy will pursue me. If you trace radaf through the Hebrew Bible, almost always the person that's doing the radafing is a hostile enemy. So the enemies are pursuing God's people, or when God's people are at war, they are pursuing their enemies if things are going well. We've had enemies in the context here, and so this is kind of a surprising turn here. Now all of a sudden the psalmist is going to expect to be pursued. Surely I'm going to be pursued, but by goodness and mercy. The goodness and mercy of Yahweh. Kol yamei chayai. All the days of, yamim in the construct, and my life, chayim, with the first common singular suffix. All the days of my life. V'shavti b'veit Yahweh la'orek yamim. And I will return in or into the house of Yahweh for length of days, for a real long time. And the initial verb there is the perfect form, vav consecutive perfect form of shuv. It could be alternately pointed as the infinitive construct of yashav, if you had a hirik under the first shin. And the Masoretes don't suggest that as a kere reading, but the editors in BHS at least entertain that this could also be read as shivti, the shivti. And that actually is how most English translations take it. I will dwell. It would be Yeshav. I will dwell in the house of Yahweh for length of days, for a very long time. What do we do with this psalm? Just have a minute here to comment on how we want to take it. I might just ask the question, who wants to be a dumb sheep? Who would want to be a sheep? We live in an age that, in a culture that values freedom and autonomy, self-reliance, independence, self-expression, self-respect, self-esteem, self-realization, in other words, individualism. And some people have even noted that that perhaps is why this psalm is so treasured in our society. This isn't flock language, it's sheep language. It's just me and God, and maybe that's why Americans really latch on to Psalm 23. But others have said maybe Psalm 23 is not only a symptom of our individualism, but also an antidote for our individualism. It's not just the individual, but it's the individual who understands himself only in the light of and under the care of Yahweh. So the psalm speaks for the me, but it's the me embraced and enfolding in Yahweh's loving care. So true freedom is seen to be freedom from want freedom from enemies, freedom from shame, and freedom from death, the freedom to dwell with Yahweh. And that's found only under our Good Shepherd. The New Testament imagery of Jesus as our Good Shepherd, we can leave for the Gospel reading.